I met Yul over at the Holly Springs group. Meets on Tuesdays at 6. We do a big book study and learned a little bit about him since then. I know he just celebrated a major birthday, and I was absolutely amazed that he had been around that long. He just doesn't look old enough to have been around that long. But then again, I knew another guy who hit 40 before he turned 60, so you can do it. I couldn't, but it can be done. So anyway, Yul, please talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been a while, actually. I've been since anybody's asked me to do this, so I feel honored to do it tonight. And I'll just get started. You know, my sobriety date is February 19th, 1981. So I was 21 years old when I got sober. It didn't take me long to go downhill. You know, I got this thing and I got it bad. I'll just tell a little bit about my childhood, and you know, I was born to pretty much an ideal family. Mother and father. Mother was a public health nurse down in Mitchell County. My father was the superintendent of the schools and the basketball coach and all that. And we had a great family. Had an older sister, and you know, that only lasted a few years. When I was four. My father was killed in a hunting accident, you know, and I didn't realize at the time. I was just 4 years old. I didn't know, you know. I thought it's one of those things. It just happens. But later on, I came to realize how much of an effect that had on my life. You know, my mother, it's kind of a funny thing. My grandmother was visiting, and she never went home. She lived with us till she passed away. And we actually shared a room, and because it was just a small country house down there in Camilla, Georgia. It was a little town of about, I think there's 6,000 people there now. I don't think there was even 4 back then. So she would snore like a freight train. I don't know how a little petite lady could make those noises, but man, she could do it. We call her Granny, you know. She, like I said, she spoiled me rotten. You know, I distinctly remember one of the funniest things I remember about her was when I'd get in trouble, she'd chase me around with a fly swatter and go spank me, and she'd never catch me because I could outrun her, you know. But, I mean, just tell you how bad she spoiled me. I mean, everybody remembers the old Morton's pies you could get and bake them, and they were, you know, a little peach pie or an apple pie. She'd set one of those out for us and for me and my sister, and I'd get home from school for my sister, and I'd eat the whole freaking pie. And my sister told me about 10 years ago how resentful she was about all these years. I said, hey, I was a 6 or 7 year old kid. I wasn't going to turn down all that pie if she was going to let me eat it, you know. But so you can see the selfishness started at a very early age. I mean, it was all about me. You know, I was going to eat that pie. I didn't care. I just didn't matter what she wanted. I wanted the pie, you know. So, and that, you know, my mother got remarried to a nice gentleman in Camilla, and you know, that didn't work out. He had an older stepbrother that used to pick on me all the time, you know, and that's just, you know, that's what older brothers do, you know. And there's a couple of things that happened around that time, and I talk about this not for sympathy or anything, because it's for identification. I mean, there was a lot of abuse in my life and in my story, and you know, both sexual and physical. So about 7 years old and about 10 year old, I was abused, you know, sexually by another boy in the neighborhood and a girl in the neighborhood. So, and I tell that because I know there's a lot of people in these rooms that have those experiences. I mean, it's just uncanny how many times I've shared that, and somebody that says asked me to sponsor them, and that's their story too. It's just, we can pick each other out. It's crazy. I mean, I know somebody that was going to write a book one time, and they said that 75% of the women that answered this survey in treatments, centers said that they'd been abused, and 50% of the men. 50% said they'd been abused. The real number's a lot higher, you know. So, like I said, it's not for sympathy, it's for identification. That's just, it's part of my story, and it's something that happened to me, and it definitely had an effect on me. There's no doubt about it. But we'll get to that later. So, you know, they ended up getting divorced, and my mother started dating an old high school sweetheart. He was a big guy, 6'6", big personality, one of those kind of people. Just he came into a room and he was one of us. You know, I know today that I probably never saw him sober from the time ever until he actually got in this program. You know, I mean, he had a drink all the time. He'd pick us up from school because he was an engineer, and he'd get off work and 3:30 in the afternoon. He'd pick us up from school, or he'd be the first one home. He's immediately pouring him some wild turkey, and you know, going. I mean, it was going. I mean, if he was taking us to a ball game, there was a drink in one hand, and he was driving down the road. I mean, we just, it's just what we grew up with, you know. I'm sitting here thinking, over the years, I can't really pinpoint the first time I had a drink, because it was such a common thing in my family. And there, if I just wanted to grab a sip, I just grabbed a sip and tasted it, you know. I mean, that's what we did when we were kids. I mean, I just, did it register anything at that time? Not really. But everybody else was doing it, so there had to be something to it, right? You know, and you think about this thing, nature or nurture, you know, that's always a question that people have. And I look back on my experience. I mean, obviously, you know, my stepfather was a mean drunk. I mean, he'd get drunk and we'd say the wrong thing and we'd get knocked across the room, you know. I mean, that's just the way it was. We didn't do right. It just was constant. It was always putting us down because we... And I know today that he was doing that because he was an alcoholic, and we don't feel like we measure up, so we got to put everybody else down to make ourselves feel okay. And he was a super smart guy. I mean, we took a wall out like this, put a steel beam in the house. It was me, him, 4 years younger stepbrother, and my mother. Put a steel beam and a supporting wall across the house to add on to the house. I mean, that's the kind of stuff we did. I mean, we didn't pay anybody to do anything. We re-roofed the house. We fixed all the cars. That's just kind of, that's the way he was. He goes, I can do it better than they can do it, and I'm not paying them to do it. You know, so that's what we were always doing something, always had to be doing something. But, you know, thinking back on all that, and my family, on my grandmother's side, my father's side, I mean, my one aunt, we don't know if she was suicide or a drunk driving accident and ran into a bridge abutment. Everybody, all the family said it was suicide. Got an aunt that died from this thing, another aunt that died from it. My uncle was a liquor salesman all his life, and he partook in what he was selling quite heavily, you know. So I had an uncle, I remember we called him Uncle Runt, and you know, we were scared of him as kids. I mean, he was drunk. He was one of us, but he couldn't get sober. It was pitiful, y'all. I mean, he lived in an old, just imagine we're driving down the road and there's just this little country shack there that was just a few, I could hit a golf ball to the house from my grandmother's house. I mean, it was pretty close. It was on her farm, and she just let him live there. And I have one memory of him. We went in the house because it was like he was like the black sheep of the family. It was like Uncle Ron. We were all scared of him, you know, and something was weird about him. And I remember going in there, it was me and one of my cousins, and he was just passed out on the floor. And in my mind, I'm sure this isn't true, but in my mind, there was no furniture in the house. I mean, it was just a wooden floor. It was pitiful, y'all. It was pitiful. But he was one of us. So I got this thing coming and going, so I can't sit here and give myself an excuse for saying, oh, well, maybe I don't have it. There's no way. With all the family history, and I do believe that this is a genetic thing because I've just seen it too many times. So, you know, growing up in the high school in the 70s, and, you know, it was on. Everybody was doing whatever, you know. And it was growing up there. He was so strong-handed. I was scared to death of him. Y'all. I mean, he's 6'6", mean, you know. And again, just to tell you, I was cutting the neighbor's yard one time, and the lawnmower was scalping the yard. So I just raised the blade on it, or raised the wheels on it, and I didn't do it right. And you know, he hit me across the face with a pipe wrench for not doing it right. So, I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. And, you know, and I'm not, again, that's my story. You know, other people, that was a different generation. You know, a man's man, and you were going to be tough, and you were going to pick yourself up by the bootstraps, all that stuff. You know, he was an ex-Marine, so we had all that stuff going on. And, you know, he tried to run a really tight, you know, keep us under his thumb, because he knew what he did when he was our age. He was running crazy, you know. But so I kind of, I tried to be the good kid, you know. I grew up going to church. I mean, we got involved, and I got baptized in the Southern Baptist Church there in Camilla at 7 or 8 years old. So I was always around the church. I never had any trouble believing in God. I mean, I just always believed in God, you know. And it was my choice to get baptized as a kid. Nobody forced me to do it. So I didn't have a real, you know, problem with God. I just, you know, I was just like all of us, or a lot of people I've talked to, I just never felt like I fit in. You know, I remember all the way back, as far as I can remember, really never being comfortable in my own skin. You know, I just never felt comfortable. And so, being scared to death of him, I didn't run too crazy for most of my... I'm not one of these guys that started at 9 or 10 years old or something like that. I was more like about 16 when I really started. And, you know, just would have a beer or a drink here or there. Of course, it was the 70s. We were doing other substances, you know, smoking pot and doing all that stuff. So, I mean, it was never one thing. It was all of it all together at the same time, you know. So, and I remember the first time I really got away and went to a party and felt like I was let loose, you know, and had the SAT the next morning. On the side of the driveway is, and I mean, y'all, I drove the car for like half a mile down the street. You know, I didn't have to drive. I could have walked down there where the party was, right? But I pulled my little car in there next to the willow trees along there where I always parked it, and I'm so drunk, I scrape it all up against the side of the trees and everything, you know. I mean, that's just, and I got to get up the next morning and go take the SAT. Now, is that not a classic, you know, alcoholic story? I mean, that's just what we do. That self-destruction, that was there. And so about that time, that's when I really started running with, I don't want to say the wrong crowd, because, hell, I was just like them. I was the wrong crowd, you know. And prior to that, I'd been on the football team, you know. I've always been fairly athletic, so baseball, football, all that stuff came easily to me. And, you know, but it's like, the minute I started that, that summer we would have to go and do workouts in the summer during the school year before summer practice started. And once I started drinking and partying, I didn't show up for a single summer practice. Our summer weightlifting session, that's what it was. So, of course, when it came time to for the season to start, the coach wasn't real happy with me. So rather than face the music, I just told him I was going to quit, you know. So I quit the football team. I did play on the golf team, but that's how it was, has always been a constant in my life. And so I, but, you know, I mean, we'd go to the matches and we'd have a few drinks or whatever else we were doing on the way, because we'd drive from over there, and grew up in Spaghetti, right there at the corner of Spaghetti Junction. We moved to Atlanta when I was about 11 years old, right there with Northcrest. That old double-decker driving range is, Embry Hill, Shamley Tucker, in that area right there. That little neighborhood right behind that's where I grew up. And so we would go from there to Stone Mountain to play in our matches and things, and me and the other kids were, we were doing whatever, you know, we could do. And we'd show up at the matches and play our matches higher, a couple sheets to the wind, you know. I mean, it's just what we did. And nobody ever said anything. We never got caught. We never got in any trouble. So my parents thought I was a pretty good kid, and I was going to the church. And, you know, some of the people that introduced me to some of this stuff were the kids I was meeting at the church youth group. So we all thought we had them fooled, you know. And I remember playing church league basketball. I hurt my knee and ended up having to have surgery. And when I had the surgery, we figured out that I was allergic to morphine and codeine, so I couldn't take opiated painkillers. So I would do, that was between my junior and senior year. And my senior year, started doing that dual enrollment. That was fairly new back in those days in the 70s. That was pretty new. I was going to DeKalb Community College over there in, I don't remember what it's called now, but that was over in Clarkston, over there almost on Memorial Drive. And I'm driving from Henderson High School, which is over at North Lake Mall. So I would get up in the middle of this class, one class, and just walk right out the door and go get in my car. Teacher didn't care. It was, I don't remember, it was some strange hippie class. I don't know, the general discussion or something. We'd just sit around and talk about stuff. It was a strange class. So I could just get up, walk out, and like 15 minutes to spare. And, of course, I discovered that smoking a joint was about the only thing that would stop the pain in my knee, because I couldn't take painkillers. So every day, that was my excuse. I'd smoke a joint on the way to college classes, and God knows what I smelled like when I walked in that room, you know. I wasn't fooling anybody. I was just out of it. And that pretty much is when it really started. And I didn't slow down too much. But again, somehow I managed not to really get in trouble. And I'd just sit here and think about how much I was doing and what I was doing. And I remember one time coming back from somewhere, being drunk, and of course hitting somebody's mailbox, and I get home and the car's all scratched up. My stepfather says, "We're going to go out there and we're going to find those people and you're going to fix their mailbox." And so we go driving up and down Shamley Tucker, you know, when you're going through by Tucker High School and all that. It was somewhere along that road, and I could never find it, and I don't know what the guy out there. I might not have been on that road for all I know. that's just how we go. And and of course, the humorous thing about that story is that, you know, my mother or somebody asked me, how many did I have? I only had two, you know. Yeah. I remember telling a cop one time, he stopped me, I never got a DUI. I mean, you know, one time I remember, and we were there in Camilla, 16. I mean, not even drinking age back then was 18. So I'm 16, driving me and my cousins around. We found some little convenience store in Albany to sell us beer, or somehow we got some liquor, you know, and we're coming out of Camilla, going back to my grandmother's, because we'd sneak out, we'd roll my car down the driveway, down the dirt driveway, crank it up, and we would drive 20 miles to Albany and get our stuff to drink, and, you know, we'd come back, and I mean, we were, man, you know, we were in bad shape, and, you know, I couldn't let the cop come in there and come to the car. So I get out of the car and I tell my cousins, y'all don't do anything, y'all stay in this car, don't get out. And I come out and I start talking to him, and I'm like, officer, we're just going, I told him who my grandmother was, we're just going back to her house. And of course my cousin decides he's got to get out of the car, right? And you know, the sound of two liquor bottles clinking together, there's no other sound like that, right? And that, I mean, it was as loud as could be. And I'm just like, oh, Barry, what have you done? We're going to jail now. And I'm just, and that cop let us go. I mean, I said, we're just going home. We're going straight there. And he let us go. That would never happen today, you know. And I remember I was going to the University of Georgia. and I don't know where my parents were. They were gone. I was coming back to the house, and of course, the cop pulled me over, and he had me blow into his hat. And he said, "You been drinking, son?" I said, "No." You know, I felt stone cold sober. And he said, "Hey, Johnny." He said, "You know," had me blowing it again. "You think this guy's sober?" And so he had me blowing the thing. I told him, "I only had two drinks a couple hours ago." I didn't tell him they were this big and straight liquor, you know. And that's the truth. I mean, you know. I got a funny story in Athens. There was this bar in Athens when I was going there. I only went for part of 1 year. So when you're too drunk to go to class and too hungover to go to class, you don't make very good grades, you know. Kind of got to go to class and at least make an effort, you know. My parents said they weren't going to keep paying for it anymore. But I went to this bar, and they would charge us like, I swear, I think it was $4 to get in. And you could drink all the draft beer you wanted. They lost a lot of money on me. I remember one night I went in there and I'm doing the usual, just getting drunk and trying to hook up with some girl, you know, the usual thing we do in college and bars. And, you know, I am so drunk, y'all. I got to go outside and puke. It's raining. I mean, it's pouring down rain. It ain't just raining. It's pouring down rain. And I get sick. I come back in the bar, soaking wet, like I've been standing in the shower. What do? I go sit down at the bar, and I order me another beer. Bartender looked at me like I was crazy, and he was right. You know. And the funny thing is, when I first came to this program, I'll get to that in a minute, I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. You know, but I drank like that, but I'm not an alcoholic. No, you know. So after a little bit of that, they weren't going to pay for that anymore, so I had to come home. And, you know, the funny thing is, again, even though I'm running wild, if I'm at home, I'm still so scared of my stepfather, and he's still, even though I'm 18, 19 years old at this point, I just, you know, I would straighten up when I was there. Because I don't feel his wrath. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. And I was going to DeKalb Community College, re-enrolled in there, making A's and doing well and all of that stuff. And then, of course, I decided I can't live here anymore. It's cramping my style, so I got to move out, right? Yeah, well, you can understand it. Guess what happened to my grades and everything else, you know? I had my math teacher convinced I was sick because I'd quit showing up for class because I was too hungover, you know. Didn't want to, because I'm one of those kind of drunks, I drank till I either passed out or I ran out, you know. There was no stopping me. And I was working at CNS Bank. I don't know if y'all remember them, in their mail room. And just trying to do the college thing and be a responsible kid. And, you know, it was the 70s, man. It was the late 70s, early 80s. We were just partying, you know. We were just having a good time, right? There wasn't any real problem going on, right? Well, somewhere in there, and I remember it was kind of starting to get a clue that something just wasn't right. You know, like I said, I never, ever, all through high school, as a kid in elementary school, and we moved out of South Georgia up here, I mean, I never felt like I fit in. I always felt different, you know. I mean, when I had that apartment, I had to have the best drugs, the most drugs, the best liquor. I mean, I got a job at a liquor store so I could steal from them to have enough liquor to drink, you know. That's the kind of alcoholic I was, and or am. Of course, I was selling other substances because you couldn't afford to do what I was doing. And, you know, so I wasn't doing it for the money. I was doing it so I'd have enough for me to use, you know. So that's kind of, I was selling out the back door and the front door, you know. So that was me. And but I knew something just wasn't right. Like I said, I grew up in church and I knew I kind of had an inkling to how you were supposed to act. And I knew I wasn't acting that way, you know. I don't remember too much of really, like, you know, getting crazy and wild and, you know, like really I stole from the guy at the liquor store, but I didn't steal from my friends and things like that. But again, I felt like in order for you to come hang out with me, I had to have the best drugs and the best liquor, top shelf stuff or whatever. You didn't want to be around me if I didn't have all that, you know. So the party was always at my place. So, but it was more because I had that insatiable need to be validated. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that's really what it was, you know. Plus I had this ism, you know. So somewhere along in there, I remember, you know, laying in the bed one night and room spinning, you know, imagine that. So, and I remember asking God to help me. That was all I said, was God help me. I knew I needed help. And, got up the next morning, and there's a little song that some folks think is about this substance called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And got up that morning. It was probably, 9, 10 o'clock? I don't know. I came to. I didn't wake up. I came to. That's how I did. And I remember going right to my sock drawer and grabbing that out, and I'm putting it in my mouth and telling myself, don't do this. Why are you doing this? Stop. Don't do it. But it was like an out-of-body experience, y'all. I could not do it. Even though every fiber in my being didn't want to continue doing what I was doing. You know. And who does that stuff by themselves at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning? I mean, you know, I knew. And at that point, I don't know that it was like the realization of what was wrong. That it really hit me. I didn't consciously think of it, but I've tried many times, y'all, to think back from that moment, because I mean that was a defining moment in my life, because I knew right then I had a real problem, you know. But I can't tell you from that moment to when I quit the timeline. It's like I just quit trying. I gave up or something, or it was just like I knew what the problem was. It was really on. I mean, I didn't know that I drew a sober breath from that moment till the next February when I got sober. And I've tried and tried. I mean, I think it was warm, so it may have been the summer before, spring, summer, at best, 6 months, maybe longer. I really don't know. And, like I said, I've really tried to piece it together. I've gotten some old papers out and everything, and I really can't. I was in such a fog during that time. And like I said, I just knew what the problem was. I really wanted to not do what I'd done that day, and I could not stop. And now up to that point, I really had never tried to quit. You know, I never was one of these drunks that tried this experiment, I'm only going to drink this or only going to drink that or only going to do it on the weekends. It was on every day, all day. If the day ended in Y, we were getting high and drunk. I mean, that's just the way it was. We were, you know, 20 years old, and it was the 70s, 80s, early 80s. We were going to have fun. That's just what we did, right? You know, there wasn't anything abnormal about that, or at least I didn't think there was till that a few days before, you know, till that time that I realized there was a problem. And so me and my roommate, I tell you again, I mean, we're on a beer run, I think is what we were on, and we're coming back to the apartment, and we're so wasted, we get to the door, and the door's kicked in. You know, what do? We just walk right in. You know, we're so out of it, we didn't have enough sense to say, something ain't right here, I don't know if we're getting robbed, the cops were there, whatever, we're just like, wow, man, the door's busted in. What's going on? We just walked right in. So, of course, there's a bunch of cops standing right there, 38 right in my face. One of my kids one time asked me, you ever had anybody point a gun at you? And I said, yeah, I've had that happen once. You know, and it's like I said, I was selling out the front door and the back door. They were there because of what I was doing on the, yeah. I was selling drugs. I mean, that's just what I was doing. And to support my own habit, not to, again, not to try to make money or any of that. But like I said, we were on a beer run. There was always alcohol. I mean, the refrigerator always had beer. We always had, because my stepfather drank Wild Turkey, we drank Wild Turkey. That's what high-class drunks do, right? That's what high-class drinkers do. I was never much for vodka or any of that stuff. A little tequila maybe now and then, a little gin, but mostly I was a bourbon drinker and beer drinker. And, you know, they didn't even have wine coolers when I got sober. So when they came out with wine coolers, I thought, that sounds interesting. They go, what are you, some idiot? You never drank wine. Who cares what a wine cooler tastes like? You know? But that's what us alcoholics think, right? So, of course, I go into this this apartment. I get arrested. It was, like I said, it was in February. So I want to say it was probably 5:36 o'clock. We had been on a beer run or to get some food or something. And they took us to jail, and I had to, y'all, you know, when you're doing the things I was doing at 21, you're not calling your mother on a regular basis, you know. You're just not, because you don't want her to know what you're doing, right? You know, I still to this day remember having to make that one phone call, and I called my mother, you know, called her mother and stepfather, and how excited my mother was that I had called. She's like, oh, hey. And I'm like, Mom, I'm in a little trouble. I got caught with a little bit of pot. 2 pounds. So, of course, being the good enabler that she is, they came and bailed me out, and under one condition, I had to move back in with them because, of course, you know, the bond was pretty high. So they were going to put their house up as the bond, property bond. And so I had to stay with them until then, until my court date. And my mother, being a public health nurse, now I'd never heard of any of the 12-step programs. And you know, so we had a few discussions, and she suggested that I go to a meeting. I was like, because remember, I had made that prayer. I was miserable. I mean, I knew something was wrong. I was desperate for something to be different. I just didn't know what or how, you know. And I moved back in with them, and I say my sobriety day is February 19th, just because I was in such a fog, y'all. It was in that neighborhood. I think it was actually the 14th, but it doesn't matter, you know. It was in that time frame, and she suggested I go to a meeting, and so I went to Peachford. It was actually an NA meeting. It was my actual first meeting, and I don't know if you guys have ever been to that Friday night meeting at Peachford. It was back in the day. Of course, I thought there was 300 people there. There might have been 100, but it was a big room. It was 3 times as big as this place and the cafeteria there, and there was a speaker, and it was this guy's birthday, Glenn R. I don't know if some of you know Glenn. It's Bill R.'s son. Bill just passed away with like 50-something years sober. So, you know, being newcomer, no clue what's going on. I just go in. I watch this. Back then, birthdays were a big celebration. They had a cake and roasting, basically, you know. It was his one-year birthday. And as soon as that meeting's over, y'all, I'm out the door. I don't remember it other than that it was his birthday. I really don't remember. But I remember, if you've been to Peachford, you take a left out of the parking lot, and you're going down to the light, and you turn right, and you're going to get back on 285. As I go under that bridge, I don't know if it was a thought, if it was a voice, or what it was, but it was not outside of me. It was in me, and it said, if you want to get sober, you better turn around and go back. I am convinced today that that was God talking to me. I really am, because 21-year-old dope head drunk, we don't think like that. Where did that thought come from? I don't know, y'all. That's the only way I can explain it. It scared me. You know, am I crazy or am I hearing God? I mean, either one, somebody might tell you you're crazy, right? So what did I do? I went right to that gas station. I turned around, I went back, and I walked right up to Glenn, and I said, this was my first meeting. What do I do? And, you know, there was a bunch of young people there. I mean, I was 21, and I wasn't even close to the youngest. I remember 14, 15-year-old kids being in there. And I know somebody that's still sober today from that time that she got sober at 16. You know, so they immediately took me in and said, you know, this is what we do, this is where we're going. The next night they were going to go to 8111 Club, and so they said, meet us there. And so I agreed to, not having a clue what I was getting myself into, but I kind of knew, like, I just the vibe of the place, the feel of it, what they were talking about, the way I don't remember so much any one conversation during those first beginning of the program for me, but I remember the feeling. These people knew how I felt. These people felt like I felt. And I could relate to them. And I understood that they were like me. And remember, I've never felt like I fit in, ever, anywhere before. So finally, I might fit in this place, you know. They're like me. And I'm pretty convinced that at that moment, the desire to drink and use was removed from me when I had that thought. And that was a blessing. You know, I was desperate. I didn't want to keep doing what I was doing. So we went to the 8111 Club. And being the good newcomer that I was, I had tickets for the Bruce Springsteen concert the next night, and I was going anyway. And they were, of course, telling me not to go. Somehow, through my own best devices, I stayed sober that night, but came back and got involved with them. And I remember it was, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. I bet we went to 120 or 130, maybe even. I mean, we were going to meetings all the time. And it was, you know, the NA clubhouse, the 8111, I mean, they would have dances. I mean, y'all, it was just like being in the bar minus the alcohol and the drugs. You know, there was the nightlife almost to it, these things. There was something almost every month, every weekend, every meeting. We would go to the meeting. We'd get there an hour early, and we'd hang out. We'd eat. We'd go out to eat after the meeting. I mean, it was an event. You know, and at 21, I needed that. If I'd have just come to a meeting and left, I don't know if I'd have made it. I needed the social aspect as well as the program. And I remember that back then. There was, like I said, there was tons of young people. And we got sober. We were just all running together. And there's a lot of those people that are still sober. There's a lot that aren't. So quite a few that are dead. You know, this is like a doctor friend of mine in Albany used to say, this thing it's not a nosebleed. It's a terminal illness that will kill me if I don't treat it. And so there's a lot of them, that didn't make it. You know, we got sober, did all the things you do in sobriety. You know, I've heard it said that sobriety is like a country song in reverse. You know, I got my car back. I got my wife back. I got my, you know. So, but since I was 21, I didn't have any of that stuff. Nobody was going to marry me, the kind of guy I was, you know, or much less hang out with me much. But so I started going to meetings, met a girl, got married, did all those things, got a business, had a couple kids. As we kept progressing, and she was in the program too, still is, and when we moved to North Carolina, we didn't go to as many meetings. And you know, I think about things. I got to tell y'all something about what happened that night when we were leaving North Carolina to go to Albany, because I was working with Domino's Pizza, and I bought a franchise in Albany and was moving down there. That day, I'm pulling a little U-Haul in with a Honda Accord, and I'm driving down the road too fast. You know, just because you're sober doesn't mean you get smart. that thing started doing all this stuff, and y'all, I literally ended up with that car. It felt like I was this close to the median. And I don't know how I didn't hit it, but I didn't hit it. And I got it right, got on, went to my in-law's house there in East Point, spent the night, and then went down. And that night, my ex-wife was in back in Durham, at our house in Durham. And we lived on a cul-de-sac. And we used to be the first, if you went in the cul-de-sac and did the U thing, we were the first house on the right. Well, they were cutting a new neighborhood through there. She's coming back. She was a nurse at the hospital. She's coming back from the hospital, and there's some guy standing at the stop sign, and the lights hit him, and he hesitates, and she gets out and comes in. And she was seconds away from getting this guy. They had pictures of him, you know, the sketches and stuff of somebody going around, and, I mean, he was coming up behind women and slitting their throats. I mean, you know, a few seconds away from, you know. So I think back, and I don't bring that up. I just bring it up because it's just, you look back on this life and you can see God moments, you know, because we both should not have, we could both easily have been killed, both of us, that one day. It's crazy stuff, you know. You start looking for signs. They're everywhere. We just got to tune in and, you know, see them. But we would go to meetings. We were involved. We were very involved there. We went, like I said, we went to I remember the name of the clubhouse there, and the NA clubhouse over there. Anyway, we would go there, and we would go to Biscayne Room, 8111. I mean, we were always in meetings. And we moved to North Carolina. You know, we're getting busy. We're doing things. We're our life's turning around, you know. Our life is great. I mean, we're moving up in the world. And isn't that why we got sober? I mean, I remember us having that conversation. Isn't that why we got sober? Yeah. So, but, you know, they didn't do it like y'all do it here in Atlanta. So we started going to less meetings. And we go to Albany, and down there, they really don't do it like you do up here. It just wasn't home, and rather than us adjusting to it, we just started drifting away. And we got real involved. We had a couple kids, two sons, and, you know, they, thank God, they've never seen me drunk. Business was doing fine, and we just got real involved in the church and just stopped going to meetings. You know, I would probably say I probably went almost 10 years without going to a meeting. Now, I went to church every day. Every Wednesday when it was open, every Sunday, I was praying. I was keeping contact with God as I understand Him. But I do not recommend that recipe. That is not a recipe, because I can tell you, you don't need alcohol to be crazy. You know, it's called alcoholism for a reason. You know, you don't need this thing. Oh, and I left out a real important part of my story. I remember, you know, they took me to jail. And the day that I had 6 months sober, I had to go to jail for what I'd done. And the judge was standing there thinking, and he asked my lawyer, when he decided to give me, he was going to give me a year in Jackson, and he decided to give me 90 days in county jail, in DeKalb County Jail. And he told my lawyer when it was time for the sign off of my probation that he still to that day didn't know why he did that. You know. And so I got to do my 90 days. I'm going to meetings all the time. I'm heavily involved in the program. I get out, and this lady that I knew from the meetings was a probation officer. And she asked to be my probation officer. She's in the program too. And she wanted me to start a pilot program in Georgia for sending people to meetings. You know, I was her guinea pig, because she knew it wasn't because I was guinea pig. Something she wanted to do, they were doing it in other states, and she wanted to get it implemented in Georgia, and she knew I was getting sober and staying sober, and I stayed sober in jail. And I remember, y'all, I remember these moments and things. There was a guy in the jail, and he used a Bic pen to shoot up. And I remember sitting there watching him do that in jail. I mean, we're in a room no bigger than this with 60, 80 guys. I mean, it just, and thinking, man, if I don't stay the course, this is what I have to look forward to. This is what my life is going to become. You know, and that was another really important moment. And so to get back to more recent times, life was getting great. I mean, we were doing well. We like I said, we weren't going to meetings. And the ex-wife decided, my oldest son has bipolar and ADD and all this stuff, and was having a lot of problems at the time. And of course, we didn't. Her solution was start drinking again at 21 years sober. And I remember thinking one time after we realized that she just back and forth couldn't stay sober, and thinking, well, hell, if she's going to get drunk, I just might as well get drunk with her. You know, I was maybe a year behind her, and that scared me to death. So what did I do? I knew what the solution was. I tucked my tail between my legs, and I ran straight to the nearest AA meeting. And I got so involved again, just like I was a newcomer again. I mean, I was in meetings every day. And, you know, it didn't have to be that way, but you know what? It was. And so we read that line in the book about resting on our laurels. I know all about that, y'all. It's easy to do. You can talk yourself into, I don't need to go to that meeting. I've been sober so many years. Isn't that why I'm sober? So I'll be a nice and responsible member of society and all that stuff we told ourselves, because we knew what we were doing wasn't really what we needed to be doing. And, you know, again, it's just God's grace. It's because I prayed every day and I asked God to keep me sober every day. I think that's the only reason I stayed sober through all that. So I just threw myself back into this program, got a new sponsor, because, of course, the sponsor I'd had from back in Atlanta, I hadn't talked to him in years, you know. I mean, we might go back to visit family or something and, run across them or something, but we didn't. I didn't. And I threw myself into this program again, just like I was a newcomer. And it worked. Saved my life, you know. And one of the things that I came to realize, because I would go through, when I would experience losses in my life, whether it was, of course, when she would drink, and finally it just got to the point where I said, you're either getting sober or you're leaving. So she got sober and decided, I needed to leave. Of course, you know how we alcoholics are. I was her problem. It wasn't her, right? You know, and that's okay. I mean, that's God bless her from a distance. I wish her no ill, but honestly, it'd probably be the best thing she ever did to me, other than my two kids. I mean, we had things were good in the beginning, but she had some issues and some mental illness, and I was a Christian man, and I wasn't going to leave her, you know. So, but when she decided that she wanted something different, it's like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. But every time I would experience some kind of loss, I figured out that had a good friend in the program that was a counselor as well, and he told me he thought I needed to go, that I should go for some counseling. And, because of the issues of, the abuse, the loss of the father, all of that stuff, I had some serious abandonment issues. You know, when I did my first four step, I put all that stuff down on there about the abuse, the sexual abuse, but I didn't tell my sponsor. So when that book tells us that I was so ashamed of all that. You know, now it's going to be on tape. It's already on tape out there. See what this program will do to you? It doesn't matter. It's my story. You know, it's part of what it is. And that was some great advice, because I learned a lot about myself. And I'd worked all the steps. And, y'all, I did another four step at 24 or 5 years sober. With my sponsor, I found a four-step guide on the Jaywalker site. If you know that AA site, if you don't, look it up. pull up their four-step inventory. If you want to do a real inventory, their guide. I mean, I wrote a freaking novel, y'all. It took me and my sponsor two sessions to go through that thing, you know. And it was one of the best things I've ever done for myself, and it was way more in-depth. Because what it does is it takes and you write down the resentment, and then it asks you all the questions and how that resentment affects every area, not which one, like the little checkbox where you check off the one it affects the most. No, you got to identify how it affects everything. And it's really, if you really want to get rid of that baggage, I'd recommend finding that inventory and doing that one. So, you know, I'm kind of running out of time. There's always more to talk about, and you know, that was huge. And so I ended up getting out of that business there in Albany and came to Atlanta. And you know, a lot of times I hear things in meetings where people, the old saying that you can't have fear and faith in the same time. I don't know, y'all. I was pretty scared when I made the move from, I completely got out of the restaurant business. I'm in the PGA now. I'm a golf pro. I was going a completely different direction. Leaving all that behind, I was scared, you know, but I knew the restaurant business, I ended up getting out of that just because it was driving me nuts and it wasn't doing well anymore, so I needed to get out of it and came here, and I wasn't going to make the same mistakes I made when we moved, every time we moved. So first thing I did was found the meetings. I went to the Canton group. Every Tuesday and Thursday I was there, you know. And because it's not about how y'all do it. Y'all do it the way you do it, and it's working just fine for you. If I want to get this thing, I'm the one that needs to adapt, not you guys. You know, y'all been here for a long time without me, and y'all will go right along without me. I need you. You don't need me. You know, and that's the deal of this program. And so I got really involved. Ended up, me and Stephen and Tom got together, and every Thursday night we'd go through this book and did our own big book study and went through the book. And then the group asked us to do that for the group. So me and Tom did a Joe and Charlie thing for, gosh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. Every Thursday night we would go through this book, and I'm sure it helped a lot of people. But there's one person it definitely helped, and that's me, you know, because I really got into this book and learned some things that about myself and about this program that I didn't know, even though I'd been sober a long time. There's just no substitute for getting involved in this book, working with others. I mean, you know, I'm going to read one passage from the book, but really my favorite thing in the book. Because it's, you know, I could talk for another hour, but y'all don't want to let me bore you. That would be rude of me. On page 45, you know, you got to remember when they wrote this book in the 30s, there were three meetings in the whole world. And they were trying to tell the world what this program is about and how to work this program. And I'm sure most of you know it. The line on page 45, it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Remember, they wrote this book to explain the program. So what is that's saying, basically, so, well, that's exactly what this program is about. It's about finding. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. If you work this program, you will find that power. If you work these steps, you will find that power, and your life will change. Now, you know, I tell my kids all the time, it's not about, you know, people ask you, oh, how's life treating you? Well, life's treating me just like life treats me. The difference is how I react to it. And I react to it differently because of this book and this program. I don't react the same way I used to react. I mean, if I wanted to get resentments, I got to tell you, there's some members around there I could get resentment every day if I wanted to. But instead, I take an attitude of, like the book tells me, to be of maximum service to others. My job is to serve them and make sure they have a pleasant experience. If they're a jerk, that's their problem. You know, and all that comes from this book. So if you're new in this program, find a good sponsor. Work the steps like they're laid out in the book. Not some new age. We ain't California sober. I don't believe in that crap. If you don't know what that is, I'll tell you later. You're either sober or you're not. You're either connected with the Spirit or you're not. God is everything or He's nothing. That's what the book tells us. And that's the answer for me. No matter how I feel, and I used to have this illusion that, you had to wake up every day and be happy and all that stuff, and everything had to be great. And you know what? Reality is just not that way. Some days I wake up on the wrong side of the bed. You know what? I don't feel right. I got a bad attitude. As my sponsor Danny says, good morning. I can start my day over. That's what this program has taught me. I can start my day over anytime I want. And I don't have to live in that. And I didn't have those tools when I was 21. The only tool I had was alcohol and drugs. The only way I could survive. Because I couldn't stand. I was so uncomfortable in my skin, y'all. And today, you either like me or you don't. I'm who I am, and I got a great life today. But my sobriety is not dependent on what's going on around me. My sobriety is dependent on what's going on inside of me and my relationship with my higher power. And am I giving this thing away on a daily basis? And I try to do that. There's just no, if you're looking for something new or different, it ain't out there. If you want to reinvent how to do this program, you're just going to spin your wheels. You know, the book tells us, when I get spiritually right, the physical and the mental malady straightens out. I tried so many years to do it the other ways. So many years. And it just doesn't work. So this is a spiritual program for spiritually bankrupt people, and I was spiritually bankrupt when I got here. And I'm not anymore. Thank you.